Well, welcome to everybody and to those of you who were not here yesterday in another event that we had leased in conjunction with the European Institute. This is the first of our seminar series for this year. And before I forget, I would like to announce the forthcoming seminars, just to put them in your diaries. Quite some distance between some of the seminars. So our next seminar in this series is on 18th of November. Dr. Milford Bateman will be talking on imposing local neoliberalism in Southeast Europe, focusing on microcredit finance in the Balkans. And then on the 2nd of December, Wednesday, 2nd of December, we have a seminar by Loring Hridey, very bad pronunciation, on constructive incoherence, contesting Kosovo status in the European Union. So we have a bit of an economic and a bit of more political topics, but also visit our website and you will find more events as we organize them. But today, it is really a pleasure, and after many years, to have Will Bartlett to present a seminar. He has chaired many of these seminars and other events in Lisi. Will is a visiting fellow here now at Lisi, but he spent a number of years with us as senior research fellow at the Research Unit on Southeast Europe here at LSE. Before coming to LSE, he was at the University of Bristol, and he got a BA in economics from Cambridge and MA in development economics at SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies, and then a PhD at the University of Liverpool. He specializes on the Balkans. Most people that know research on the Balkans will know Will and his research. He has studied the Balkans both from macro policy processes, including the Stability Pact and obviously accession issues in the Balkans, but also very specifically on aspects of social policy, including economic development, regional development, decentralization, health policy, and many other that I will not bore you describing. But for a number of years now, and more recently in relation to a ongoing, I think, project. He has been looking also at the issues of the labour market and education mismatch in particular. And this is the topic of his presentation today. This work, as Will, I'm sure he will tell us, is funded by the European Commission, and Will has done a lot of work working with different international organisations and funding bodies, the European Parliament, the European Commission, the European Training Foundations, and many others, on producing research in the Balkans and very much research that feeds into policy making. And I think that's also the focus and interest of this research. So the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks very much. That's a very nice introduction. Thank you. Okay, well, as usual, made the mistake of preparing too many slides. So, but fortunately, most of them are diagrams, pictures, so hopefully it will go smoothly. I hope I get to the end, because the end is the policy recommendations, and I don't know if that's the more interesting part or the least interesting part, but when I get to sort of near the end, perhaps you let me know if I'm losing time so I can quickly jump to that. Okay, well, it's about the topic education systems in the Balkans and the relation to the labour market. And this is the overview, looking at both sides of the problem from the labour market side and the education side, with the focus on skills. And the context is the massive economic crisis, which obviously has affected all countries in Europe, but has particularly impacted on the Western Balkan countries. Perhaps not been so much in the headlines, but very severe impact, which has affected the inflows of resources from outside the region into the region. And I would say in the 2000s, the countries were doing very well. You can see here that sort of above 5% growth rate on average in the years leading up to the crisis. And it seemed that this is a sort of takeoff period, and at last, the economies and societies which had suffered so much and had been in such difficulty in the transition process seemed to be doing very well. And then suddenly, unexpectedly to everyone, the crisis hit, and the first of all the financial crisis, followed by the crisis of the Eurozone, which has, I think the Eurozone crisis has had the bigger spillover effect, because the economies are, most of them are very much tied to the euro currency by various pegs, and even adopting the euro in the case of Montenegro and Kosovo. And so this has had this massive impact, and the growth rate, the average growth rate in the years following the crisis has been close to zero rather than above five. So this has also huge implications for, you know, how to get out of the crisis. And there's been much discussion of the new growth model and the need for an industrial policy based on the upskilling of the labour force. But, I mean, there's always alternatives. And the alternative is a sort of low-skill, low-wage strategy, which could be feasible, I suppose, if the idea is to increase competitiveness and increase exports and create a sort of external surplus. Then one way to do it is by cutting down on labour costs and making yourself more competitive in that way. And that seems to be the approach, let's say, of the external institutions. IMF and World Bank seem to be proposing or insisting on reducing labour costs, and labour market reforms is the thing of the moment, which is designed to do that. But the other strategy is more based upon high skills, high wages, and getting out of the so-called middle-income trap, which is a stage which countries seem to get stuck in when they make some progress towards catching up with the advanced countries, and then their wages go up and their wage costs are too high. But also they don't invest enough in the human resources, then they will get stuck. And it's really the human resources that are critical to getting out of this middle-income trap. So that's why the skills issue is so important. So looking at the labour markets, you see the labour markets in the region mostly are quite different to labour markets in Europe, and so far as they're characterised by these tremendously high unemployment rates, which have only increased with the crisis. You can see here that at the top we have Kosovo and Macedonia with unemployment rates of about 30%. And we've got Greece up there catching up fast, but still it's the Western Balkans are sort of not so much in the news as Greece, but they are in a similar sort of dire position in that respect. If we also then look at the employment rates, probably can't see this very well, but on the left-hand side there is the names of all the EU countries, and I've put in, this is data from Eurostat, and I put in the data for the Western Balkan countries. You can see that, you know, the employment rate, which is currently the sort of target more than the unemployment rate for let's say the Europe 2020 strategy, it's on target of 74% for the employment rate. I think it used to be 70% under the Lisbon strategy. And you can see here, this is actually the employment rate for those people with tertiary education who tend to do better in the labour market. So this even more, they are, in the EU countries, this group of people are doing very well. Their employment rates are sort of 80% or something. Whereas in the Western Balkans, with the exception of Montenegro, the employment rates are below the tertiary educated people, even below the Lisbon target of 70%. And when you get down to Kosovo, you know, it's an absolutely disastrous situation. So that's another sort of angle on the severity of the labour market situation. And in our research, which I'll come on to in a moment, we've been looking recently at the position of the graduates from universities, HEIs, the jargon for the higher education institutions, the acronym. It's a bit sort of shorter. And you can see here, these are the recent graduates. This is the group that we are focusing on in the research. And you can see here that the unemployment rates vary between 32% in Albania and 58% in Kosovo, and the employment rate's only 50% at best and 28% in Kosovo. So these new graduates from the universities have a situation much more similar to the sort of youth labour market, youth unemployment, which are equally sort of astronomically high. In Bosnia, for example, youth unemployment above 60% is worse than the Greek case. So that's the situation on the labour market, and the problem that in transferring or moving away from this crisis situation is partly dependent on the improvement of the skills of the labour force, which will hopefully improve the competitiveness of the economy. So that's the justification for the research. There are actually three, Vasilis mentioned the latest project, but there's three projects that we've done in collaboration with research partners in our LISI research network. The first one was funded by the European Training Foundation, and we looked in detail at 27 vocational schools in the Western Balkan countries and also in Turkey and Israel, actually, for some reason. The second one was a Council of Europe-funded project which looked at primary and secondary schools, 49 schools altogether. And both of these projects had large-scale surveys, questionnaires of surveys of the students and the teachers in these schools. So we've got a lot of information about what's happening at school level. And, of course, it's the school students that are feeding through into higher education. And the latest research is looking at the higher education institutions. It's all higher education institutions in the Western Balkans. And we've carried out a survey of 5,000 graduates and over 1,000 employers in the region. So we have a very good picture of what's going on both sides of the skill story. Basically the conclusions of those earlier projects are that education systems are a powerful source of transmission of social exclusion. Obviously, it's not unique to the Western Balkans. This is something which is more general in market economies, but it seems to be also true there, and we have evidence for that. And there seems to be a cascading effect of exclusion as young people pass through the education system, which also is observable in the higher education system as well. The Western Balkan countries are perhaps unique in Europe in the degree to which they have a selective education system. They have what we used to call the grammar schools and the secondary modern schools, which in the region are called gymnasia and vocational schools. And there's selection in post-compulsory education stage, which is a bit later than in the UK. Here we used to have selection at the age of 11. There the selection takes place at the age of about 15. But then the choices that are made at that point then determine the ability of somebody to move on to higher education. And the evidence seems to show that this selection channels disadvantaged children into the vocational schools, which then have a lower probability of entering into higher education, and that family background has a strong effect on this. So the cycle of deprivation is reproduced through this system. And here you can see this way this sort of selection works. The yellow lines are the Western Balkan countries. This is the proportion of children which go into vocational schools, which are relatively high compared to most European countries. I mean, at the top we have Austria. Austria has a very successful vocational system with the very close links to employers and internships and the sort of dual education along the German model. But Albania is an outlier because the vocational school system sort of collapsed in the 90s when the Albanian industrial economy imploded, and they have a system of more of general schools, but more like our system of comprehensives. Anyway, so this just shows the link between the family background and the school performance. And this is the shows, you know, students which have very bad performance tend to have very bad performance on the left-hand side there. They tend to have parents who are out of work. Children with very good performance tend to be in families where the parents are going to work. So the you know, the employment situation of the parents seems to have an impact on the school performance of the children. And in addition, the parents' education level is related to the aspirations. For example, the mother or father attended university, the child is much more likely to choose to go into university rather than straight into work after completing vocational education. Okay, so that's sort of background, and to the main point, which is to look at the higher education system. And in the project I mentioned, we have there's four different ways in which we're addressing this problem. Firstly, we have compiled a database of all the higher education institutions in the region. And we have the information about all the study programs they offer, the level of degree and the number of students who are enrolled each year and complete studies each year for the last 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years. So that's sort of unique. It hasn't, basically, nobody's really got a picture previously of the overview of what's going on in the region in terms of higher education. Secondly, we have carried out two surveys, a graduate survey, and these are internet-based surveys. We have a sample size of about 5,000 for the graduate survey, as I mentioned already, I think, and over 1,000, actually, 1,400 for the employer survey. And then we've also done 84 semi-structured interviews and 6 focus groups. The interviews are with policymakers, with the managers of higher education institutions, trade unionists and chambers of commerce. So that's the method that we've employed, tackling the issue from different directions. And the what we've got then is this sort of panorama of the higher education in the Western Balkans. We found there are altogether 222 higher education institutions delivering 5,000 study programmes, half at bachelor level, 2/5 at master level, and 1/3 are delivered by private higher education institutions, which have blossomed in the last 10 years or so, or perhaps even in the last 5 or 6 years, in the sense of the growth rate of these, or the number of these private institutions has increased rapidly. Not necessarily blossomed in terms of the performance, but in terms of the numbers. Now, if you look at the students in this database, what we find is that most students are studying the sort of social sciences, the business administration and law subjects, and social science, journalism and information. 39%, so that's 2/5 of students, are opting for that sort of subject. And it's more than comparable to the EU. EU, it's more like 30% for these fields of study. So it's not completely out of line, but it is more than one would find in other European countries, most European countries. But the worrying feature is this bottom line here, the STEM subjects, the science, technology, engineering and mathematics, perhaps not the engineering part, but the other parts of that, only 11% of students have completed these subjects compared to 23% in the EU. So it's about a half are going into the subjects which might be thought of as being important if you were thinking of an upskilling, sort of high skill, high wage policy for the future. This is the detailed picture of that, the tertiary completions. And you can see down at the bottom here, you've got about 5% on information communication technology, 5% on science subjects. And this is the proportion in the STEM subjects in detail. You can see that there is some variation in the countries in the region, but it's not nearly as much as the difference between the average in the region and the EU level. So Bosnia and Herzegovina use these EU, European, Eurostat acronyms here, if you're familiar with them. There's BA is Bosnia, ME is Montenegro, MK is Macedonia, XK is Kosovo, RS is Serbia, and AL is Albania. If we turn to the private institutions, I mentioned that there was a big increase in the number of these institutions, but actually it's not. Well, there's a lot of discussion of this in the region and among policymakers and commentators. There is actually, they're not totally out of line with what you find in the EU. Something between 16 and 22% of enrolment is into private institutions. But I think the difference, I mean, the UK here, I haven't put it here, but the UK comes out, scores here, this is UNESCO data, as 100% private. Well, what that means is that the UK has most universities in the UK are non-profit making charitable organisations under some sort of charter. And probably, I don't really know in detail the education systems in these other countries, but I imagine that quite a lot of those, perhaps not the Baltic countries, but are similar sort of non-profit making. But when we talk about the private sector in the Western Balkans, we're talking about profit making organisations, profit-making businesses. And then that brings into question, you know, the whole issue of what is the educational performance of a profit-making higher education institution compared to a state-owned private higher education institution. Does the pursuit of profits mean that these universities, private universities, are essentially selling their diplomas and making it very easy for students to sort of get a piece of paper without learning any skills? Or does it mean that because they're profit-making, they need to have a high quality to attract students, to pay the high fees, and make sure that when they leave university, they get a job, so they have foster good links with employers? Yes, yeah, so there's two possibilities here, and I'll be able to say something about that. This is the data on the number of completions at public and private institutions. You can see most of the completions are in public institutions still, but some countries such as Kosovo and Montenegro, where the private sector is actually catching up in a way with, it's quite large in relation to the public sector.
What do you mean by completions?
Completions is the completing the studies, graduating graduates when they exit from the university. The number of degrees that are issued.
Does say that the Bosnia one, which is under 10, does this mean that...
No, it's private.
Yeah, but does this mean that only 10% of...
Private
only 10% go to private...
There's only 10% go to private.
Yes, this is the proportion. Yeah. Okay. No. Yeah. These add up to 100%, these two columns. So this shows the sort of mix, the balance between public and private graduates in that year, 2014. So, okay. I think this is slightly. there's this issue, this paradox of the private HEIs. Are they good or bad for the skills, essentially? What we have from the graduate survey, we have a direct insight into that, because we asked the students how do they assess the quality of the education that they were given at these different institutions, which they, if different universities they were studying in. And here, this is the sort of quite surprising result, is that it seems that in answer to this question, unanimously, or at least across all the countries, not unanimously, that there are some instances, obviously, where this is the average, where the picture looks quite different, some particular institutions. But on average, the private institutions score better amongst the graduates in this survey than the public institutions in answering this question: how satisfied are you with the quality of the education that you have received? And that's quite striking. Especially in Albania, which has recently had a quite vigorous reform of the education system, and which has resulted in the closure of almost half of the private institutions. And presumably, hopefully, these were the ones that were not performing well and were selling the degrees, and it didn't affect the ones that were doing better. But the general reform goes along with the general perception that the private institutions don't provide good quality education. And this is the question you were asking about. These are the completion rates from the different. The completion rates on the whole. I haven't shown it by private and public here because it just gets too messy. But we were interested in what are the completion rates, and this is the ratio of the number of graduates in year T divided by the number of graduates in year T minus 3 for a 3-year, the number of enrolments in year T minus 3 for a 3-year program. So it shows, you know, if 100 students started enrolled in the university or in the universities in a particular country in 2010, and they were on a 3-year program, then we count the number that graduated in 2013, and we take the ratio of those two numbers to get the completion rate. And of course, the maximum completion rate ought to be 100% if everybody graduated and nobody dropped out. But what we find, in fact, is that the completion rates are very low in some instances, at any rate. Around about 50%. So it implies about 50% of students are not completing their courses. And here we have 1-year, 2-year, 3-year, 4-year programmes. And the GVT at the bottom is the gymnasia students, vocational students, or the students that had previously attended a gymnasium school, and the students which had previously attended a vocational school. And then the T stands for total, which is all together. But just look at the G and the V. You can see there consistently the students who went to vocational school have a much lower completion rate than the students who went to a gymnasium school. So this is another aspect of that reproducing the cycle of deprivation over time.
The presumption here is that these are full-time courses, which therefore they're supposed to finish in 3 years.
I mean, yes.
Do we actually know whether they finish in 4 or 5 years?
Yes, we know. We have the information of the length of the course, of each course.
If I was supposed to be on a 3-year course, yes, but for a variety of reasons, yes, okay, like I had to work to support, yes, myself, it might take me 5 years or 6 years to complete it. I complete, but I don't complete.
Yes, yes. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is one issue that is characteristic of the region, that students are allowed to take their exams multiple times, so they may not complete for a long time, you know. But if you have a constant inflow of students into the system who are on average taking the same length of time, be it 6 years or whatever, nevertheless, you know, and then you count them after 3 years, you would still expect the flows to equate to 100% over time if they were all eventually completing. I mean, this is just an extension of the initial period. If you started at year zero, and then after 3 years, 50% hadn't completed for that reason, then you would get a 50% completion rate. But then they'd complete in, let's say, year six, and they'd add on to the numbers that should have completed in year six. So that would be, it would be an initial dip, but then it would sort of stabilise at some higher level.
Steady state,
yes. Unless they're all getting, all extending for longer and longer, ad infinitum.
More and more are coming in. I mean, there might be good reasons to suspect that more and more are coming in.
Yeah.
Especially if you were talking about high levels of unemployment, so people are avoiding unemployment by entering university.
Yeah. Okay, that's one explanation for this phenomenon, yeah. Thanks for that. Nevertheless, I think it's still, if it can explain all of that, I don't know, and the difference between gymnasium and vocational. The one other piece of information is that there is data on the completion rates in the EU, and they vary from about 47% in Italy to 80% in Denmark. And this so therefore seems to be similar to the Italian case. But I think Italian students can also take their exams ad infinitum as well. Mm-hmm. So maybe something of that going on. But nevertheless, I mean, the point being that it shows that even if it's not dropout, it means it's an inefficient education system if students can just carry on forever being perpetual students, even if that's the explanation, which it may well be, it should, I agree, it should be a good part or some part of the explanation. It's nevertheless still an indicator of inefficiency. Okay, so then
15 minutes.
Okay. Then we move on to the transition to the labour market, and what we find here is that when we ask about what help did you receive in finding a job, that overwhelmingly this is on a scale of 1 to 5, these numbers here. So 1, 5 is very much assistance from this particular source, 1 is no assistance at all from this particular source. And so what we find, we've got the on average across all the countries, 3.12 for family was the source of assistance, means it's sort of between middling and a lot of assistance on average. Whereas the Career Guidance Centre in the higher education institution is 1.36, which is somewhere between no assistance whatsoever and a little bit of assistance. So that's the thing. So showing that basically, overwhelmingly, students are getting all their assistance from family and friends. And this is the sort of capital of connections, the social capital that they are having to rely upon their connections in order to get a job after they leave university, rather than going through formal channels. Such as the Public Employment Service, that's the PES, or a Career Guidance Centre. And although this may not be something in itself necessarily a bad thing, we hear a lot in the interviews that talk about nepotism and corruption in finding a job, and in the context of this high unemployment rate, you can understand that might be the case. And especially worryingly in relation to the public sector, getting a job in the public sector is often also not just a private sector phenomenon. It's sort of depends on your family links and your friends and so on. Okay, so when we move on, we have a forecasting component in this, and we're trying to forecast the demand for graduates. And so far, we've done this for Albania. And I won't go through this detail, but we can discuss that if you want to at the end. The forecast that we have for the number demand for graduates looks like this. That's, most demand is going to be from professional in the professional sector and administration sector. and education, and they practically very little demand in manufacturing and mining. This is taking account of what the CEDIFOP calls, which is an organisation within the EU which deals with these sorts of issues, expansion demand and replacement demand. So some of the demand for graduates is coming from new jobs that are available. Other parts of the demand are coming from the retirements and the replacements you need for that. And in this particular case, in Albania, there's also quite a bit of out-migration, brain drain. Quite a few of the graduates are going to find work abroad, so that there's an extra demand, an external demand, which has to take into account. And that, taking into account that, this is the what we get. And then we then convert that into a demand from the sectors of the economy into a demand for particular types of study programs or fields of study. And what we find here is that this is the difference between these two red and blue bars tell the difference between the actual change and the forecast change. Blue is the forecast, and the red is the actual what happened in the past. And so if that continues in the future, in reality, then you can see whether the actual demand is likely to be met or not. And what we can see is information and communication technologies seem okay, agriculture and health and welfare seem okay, but you've got this huge gap in the middle. You've got this sort of gap of skills in all these different fields of study which are likely to be in demand in the future. So that's one sort of indicator of the skill gap. And then in this graduate survey, we also asked about the skill mismatch. We asked, does your the job that you hold, do the qualifications that you have, are they above or below the requirements of the job? And if they're above the requirement, then we call that an underemployment of the graduate. It's not using all the skills that he's learned at the university, or an over-education is sometimes called, or it could be an over-qualification. Different terms for the same thing. And this is what we find from the graduate survey. We find that about, for the employed, this is all the Western Balkan countries, the average, for employed graduates, about half of them are well matched, but there's a third of them, that's the yellow at the top, yellow bar at the top, which are who are overeducated or underemployed. And we also asked the inactive and the unemployed graduates in the survey about their previous job. And as you can see, as you move from employment to inactivity to unemployment, the matching performance diminishes. So what this means is that if you're vertically well-matched, if you have a well-matched job, you're much more likely to retain your employment. You're much more likely to be in employment. And the implication is that mismatch is bad for your career, basically. You're much more likely to end up in unemployment or inactivity. And then we do that for a field of study. I won't go into that. We have horizontal skill match as well. This is whether the field of study, if you studied, let's say, information technology, does that match the job? Have you got a job in a supermarket? Or have you got a job, that's more vertical, isn't it? But have you got a job in just in public administration, not dealing with information technology, perhaps dealing with something completely different? And I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing in itself. I mean, we probably think in this country that, you know, the education qualification doesn't necessarily have to match, but this is nevertheless thought to be an indicator of inefficiency of the higher education. And again, you can see the same effect here, that the employed tend to be much better matched than the unemployed and the inactive. So it also indicates the importance of matching for holding on to a job or getting a job initially, or holding on to a job, because those people that unemployed or inactive actually had previously had a job which they'd subsequently lost. And then we go into the reasons for vertical mismatch, and this is where the qualitative part of the research comes in. We have these 84 interviews, and within that there's a sort of rich seam to be mined of information and insights into the reasons why these mismatches take place. And then finally, we look at so-called skill gaps. This is from the perspective of the employers. We ask the employers, are the graduates you employ, what would you be your ideal, the ideal qualifications of your graduates for this job? And then we ask, what are the actual qualifications? And the difference between those two we call the skill gap. And then we've got different dimensions of skills, and we can sort of plot this gap according to the dimensions. And so at the top you've got, I don't know if you can see it, decision-making skills, planning and organisational skills, and at the bottom you've got computer skills, and as you go around, you've got more and more specific skills. You've got good with numbers, good with reading. So the first sort of half of that is what is known as, in the jargon, as interactive skills, and the second half is known as the cognitive skills. And what you can see here, these three coloured rings, the one in the middle, the smaller one, is the non-graduate skill gap. The middle, the blue one, is the current graduate skill gap. And so the non-graduate is a sort of benchmark. And you see that the graduate skill gap is much more in the interactive, much higher in the interactive part of the diagram. And then you've got the outer ring, which is the future skills gap. And you can see that the employers expect huge increase in the skill gap, but especially in these interactive skills. So there we've got the sector picture again, and reasons. What was that one? That was that's just by different countries. So, and then the reasons for the skill gaps. For example, the four big reasons sort of pop out of this qualitative research. One is that the universities in the region don't provide enough practical education. Employers are always saying, you know, well, we've got these graduates, but they've only learnt theory. They haven't learnt anything practical. So we don't know, we can't use them. And in fact, also, the employers are giving training, supplementary training, on in-work training to the graduates, and we look at that as well. The other second reason is that the universities don't provide enough education in the interactive skills. So somebody from the Ministry of Economy in Albania said graduates rarely acquire soft skills, which is another word for these interactive skills, and employers complain about that. Graduates lack problem-solving skills or critical thinking skills. So the problem here is being identified in the universities themselves, in the type of teaching methods and the type of teaching they're offering to the students. So it's a university's problem. And then the next one is the thing that sort of pops out is graduates have little motivation to work. Somebody from the Ministry of Economy in Serbia said they do not care enough about work. They do not work hard enough. They have lack of communication skills, professional and other skills. They are dissatisfied with the salaries and they have low motivation. Well, salaries are very low. I think you'd all be dissatisfied with the salaries. But that's certainly fairly firmly putting back the blame on the graduates themselves. And then the third view is that employers are not willing to. It's employers' fault. They're not willing to invest in training. They should. They shouldn't expect the universities to do everything for them. They should have some input into it. And so somebody from the Chamber of Commerce in Albania said, employers do not like to invest in training and adjust the new graduates to the requirements of the workplace, as they consider this to be time and money consuming. And they don't see it as an investment, they see it as a waste of money. They think that the presumably public universities, or even the private universities, whichever it might be, should have done that already. They should already have produced these sort of work-ready robots to suddenly start working on day one, and they just haven't got the idea that actually they need to put in an investment. So the various reasons have been mooted. So then the question is, what should be done about it? And I've just got three slides here, basically, looking at the three different aspects. One is about the the university's role in all of this. So we think that there's clearly too few students studying in the STEM subjects. If you want to move to a high-skill economy, you need more than 10% of the students studying these subjects. The completion rates are too low, I mean, whether it's because of dropout or whether it's because of delay in completion. And there should be measures taken to improve the completion rates. And then the teaching methods. There seems to be huge discontent with the teaching methods, especially at public HEIs. And this is interesting because most of the policy direction seems to be in terms of saying it's all the fault of the private sector HEIs. But what we found in this research is actually the public sector are equally, universities are equally as much to blame as the private HEIs. And actually the private universities seem to have much better connection with the employers than the public universities, which are very much sort of ivory towers, and they're doing this, you know, they like to teach theory, they don't really want to get their hands dirty with the world of work and so on. And then we think there should be a restriction on the ability of students to repeat exams. I mean, students basically in the region have carte blanche to take their final exams as many times as they like, 12 times. And the reason is because each time they take their exam, they get paid a fee. They pay a fee to the university, and the university pockets the fee and raises the, you know, salaries of the teachers, who in some cases are paid according to the number of students they teach and the number of students they examine. So actually there's a perverse incentive for university teachers to fail the students as often as possible in order to try to get them to repeat the exam, which they're very happy to do. And then finally, better support for graduates in finding a job. And this should be, it's about improving the information that's given. It's not just, don't just rely on family connections, actually give people information. They can make, you know, proper choices. Provide better career guidance, both at the point of exit from the higher education institution and especially in the first 3 years when the matching problem is most severe. And then internship programs to give practical experience. And this is what the Montenegrin government has done. They're offering an internship to every graduate. I mean, they don't have that many graduates, it's a small country, so it's not such a big problem as it might be elsewhere. But
excuse me, what's the financial incentive in the
Montenegrin? Subsidy.
Subsidy?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it makes employers or?
Well, to employers, yes. I mean, I think the job subsidy is becoming more accepted now. You know, 10, 15 years ago, when you'd mention a job subsidy, everybody would throw their hands up in horror, but I think it's much more accepted as a rational policy measure today because it has, you know, external benefits to society. And then finally, the collaboration between universities and employers should be improved. The survey shows there's very little of that going on. There's very little feedback from the world of work into the courses that are taught. And the courses tend, you know, they tend to be very out of date. A lot of the curricula were written years ago when the situation was completely different, especially in the, well, in all areas, really, with a few exceptions. And then I mentioned that employers do train their graduates, but again, I think they need incentives to think harder about that. And then finally, I think the upgrading of the skill content of jobs, it has to come from both sides. There's no point asking students to study the STEM subjects if there's no jobs for them. So there has to be a thing which goes along in a balanced way on both sides, that you expand the sort of high-skilled course content, and you will be also provide the high-skilled jobs that are available to the graduates, and to so that they know that when they've finished, they may have a job to go to. Okay, that's
it. Thank you, Will. Quite comprehensive, and you managed to go through 54 slides in the time allocated, so well done. I have quite a few questions, but I'm sure there's going to be questions from the audience. I would like to open it to the floor. Is the burning question for Bernard?
I want to come back to what I was asking about earlier, because I'm not quite sure if I can see what is going on in these higher education institutions. Bear in mind that I lived for years in Berlin, where people used to spend years and years going through university. So there was no such thing as a 3 or 4 year course.
Mm.
You finished when you finished. An awful lot of people were actually working simultaneously to studying. I'm not sure how much this is going on where we are talking about. But if we're talking about how people get jobs and what kind of jobs they get, there might be an awful lot of, between inverted commas, students who are simultaneously employed. And if we are looking at how people get jobs as they move from education into employment, then these kind of extended internal labour markets, which they're already participating in, might in fact be highly important. So I don't know, but there might be some kind of dual system going on there, which might be doing as good a job as is being done in somewhere like Austria, but under a slightly different name. I was sort of confused because we have people who are graduates whose employment rates or unemployment rates are being talked about, but then there seems to be a whole lot of people who were, let's say, high school graduates, but they weren't tertiary graduates because they hadn't completed. And what were they doing, and what were the students actually doing as well as being students? I would be intrigued to unpack this because I'm still not convinced. Maybe something is going badly wrong there, but I could read almost a lot of what you were saying as something very different.
Okay.
Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. The higher education system in the region is basically built on the German model of university, and they do have exactly what you've described up till now, this sort of idea of a perpetual student that can who can sort of carry on studying until he's finished. But the big change is the introduction of the Bologna system, the Bologna process, and this is designed to, as you know probably, sort of coordinate between all the European countries and provide a standard model whereby you can move from one country to another with a degree and everybody will know what you're talking about. So this is trying to bring in these more strict regulation of 3 year courses and or 4 year courses or however long the course takes. That should be the length of the course. So that's one big change that's going on. A lot of universities have moved in that direction. They've reduced bachelor studies from 4 years to 3 years.
But even that's assuming that you do it over 3 years. But I mean,
yes, okay.
Doing
bachelor's
degrees in Germany over 8 years or something
like that. So yeah, yeah. I mean, I accept what you're saying, that there may be plenty of students who are continuing on with their studies, but when we ask in the interviews and in the survey, you know, what are the problems that the graduates face, the answer which keeps coming back is that they have no work experience, they have no practical experience, and there don't seem to be jobs available for students who are doing that, who are extending their studies. It's not because they are, on the whole, working part-time in some part-time job and getting work experience. It's much more likely that they're sitting in a cafe drinking coffee, living off their parents and or their grandfather's pension. And that's the typical story. It's not like Austria. They wish they were like Austria, but they're not.
They don't drink coffee.
And so... imagine those things, but I don't think that reflects the reality of what's going on. And
other questions, Kevin? Yeah. Okay. One, two.
Bill, I would like to ask you about your forecast, I didn't understand on which basis did you ground your forecast. That's what I would like to
know. Well, most forecasts, as I learned when I was working for the Economist Intelligence Unit, I used to do the Croatian country study for the Economist Intelligence Unit, and part of doing that was to prepare a forecast for the Croatian economy. And when I started, I was asked to do this, and this is what I was told, and there was other aspects to it as well. I thought, oh my God, you know, now have I got to develop an econometric model? I'm not quite sure that I can do that, you know, but it will be very interesting to try. But it turned out that actually they don't do that. All they do is sort of go like that. And they look at what happened last year and they say, well, is it going to be 0.1% more this year or 0.1% less? And that's more or less. But I think actually I've done a little bit more than that. Well, it's actually quite complicated because you have a certain amount of information, but the information is very sketchy. And what we do know, and take the case of Albania, what we do know that in between 2011 and 2013, not 2103, the total employment was falling by 7% per annum. But at the same time, the graduate employment was increasing at 9.2% per annum. So there is some changes going on within the labour market. The demand for graduates is increasing, despite the fact that there is unemployment and so on. And as technology improves, and partly because the skill needs are increasing, but also there's this thing called bumping down, which means that when you know, employers will prefer to employ somebody with a PhD when only somebody with a master's degree would do, and all the way down, you know, a bachelor's degree when only somebody with a school, because they get a bit more human capital that way, even though they're not paying for it. So that's partly that. So that anyway, we know that. And then we have a forecast from the European Commission, the ECFIN, which produces forecasts of the Western Balkan economies, and they have a forecast for employment which shows that in 2015-2016 they expect total employment to grow at 1.8% per annum. So that's 9.1 percentage points higher than it did 2 years previously, so 3 years, no, 4 years previously. So we have the sort of down, the impact of the recession, but then they expect the economies to recover. These forecasts are never accurate. I mean, yes. The first, the only true thing about a forecast is it won't happen. Yes. It's inaccurate, inevitably. And then we've got data from the labour force survey of the growth rates in the past for the different sectors. So we have to make some sort of adjustment from what happened. We could just predict forward, you know, into the future from what happened in the past, but we can't really do that because it keeps changing all the time. So we need some sort of adjustment. So then we take some information to make that adjustment. And we use this idea of expansion demand and replacement demand. And the expansion demand is to do with the that forecast, European Commission forecast of 1.8%, but that's total employment, so you need to adjust that for graduate employment. So how much does graduate employment grow when total employment grows by 1%? So that is what economists call elasticity. And there's no data from Albania to do that, really. So I've looked at the country in the EU, in the Eurostat, which is closest in living standards and so on, which is Bulgaria. And from that, they have data for sort of 25 years. So you can estimate elasticity from that. And it comes out at 0.18, which means that the growth of graduate employment is much more stable than the growth of total employment, which can sort of go up and down. But there's always going to be a demand for graduates. And when there's a downturn, it's the low-skilled who get laid off and so on. So then we apply that to the increase which took place in total employment to get graduate expansion demand, and then we look at the Eurostat estimate for wastage or retirement, sort of demographic change in the EU, which is 3.4%, plus 6% migration to get the replacement demand. And add those together and apply it to the total and the sectors.
So forecasting means you are telling us constantly readjusting things.
Yeah, well, just take as a good as guess as you can at what you have to do, you know, how you think the future is going to be adjusted in relation to the past.
Right, we got very technical, so I'll pass the question to Kevin.
What an introduction. The most dissatisfied students were those in public universities.
Hmm.
Do we have any evidence that they are demanding university reform?
Well, yes, they are demanding that they should be able to pass their exams more easily. That's basically the nature of the demands. They're not occupying the universities in order to in the pursuit of social justice. The current group of students.
There's an element of inertia.
Yes.
But I think I have also to comment on this question, because I'm from Serbia and I study there at the public university, and I would like to take to your attention that maybe this data should be interpreted in a different way, because generally speaking, students who perform badly at gymnasium or vocational schools opt for private universities, and I think that their expectations are also much lower. And also, what does it mean, quality? The definition by public students and private students, I think that it is very different. I agree that the quality of education is lower, especially in comparison to the LSE standards. But I think this difference between public and private is not realistic, it is in this slide.
I was thinking of parallel with Greece, because probably a similar survey would result would suggest something similar in the Greek case, but a system which is seen to be underperforming on the basis of your survey. Does not have significant internal pressure for reform.
But also, how much satisfaction with a university degree is connected with finding a job? Because towards the end of your presentation, you were actually hinting that the students who are satisfied with a degree are actually the students who have a job. That's what towards the end.
Let's look into that.
Okay, let's take the next question.
First of all, thanks for your seminar. I have a question. What role do you think does nepotism or, let's say, corruption in general play in that connection between university and between university and employment? Because when I talk to my family and friends in Croatia and Bosnia, one thing they always tell me is that they could be the best educated person. If they don't know anybody who knows anybody, they won't get a job. So what you proposed, I think, are very good measures for the realm of education and employment. But how do you think, or what can be done to tackle something that is a more general underlying problem of the society?
Well, I don't have an answer to that, really. I mean, it's
if you could answer.
It's nice to know that you agree with the analysis. But well, I suppose it's. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the fact that there is this sort of high unemployment, and but also with traditions and history, because I guess the connections, the capital of connections, came from the former communist period as well, and also from the sort of low level, relatively, well, I wouldn't say low level of development is because these are sort of middle income countries, but I don't know, I mean, perhaps you can say something about this, but I agree, it is a problem. And it is, I mean, the corruption is a more serious problem than I've allowed myself to talk about in this seminar, because in the presentation, you know, at the universities. I mean, recently there have been a number of high-profile scandals in several of the countries where it's been revealed that people, you know, even rectors of one private university have plagiarised. Actually, they claim that their PhD, they had a PhD from the LSE. And they, I think they produced a photograph of this PhD with the LSE logo on it. But close examination showed that this had been pasted over subsequently. And some very...
At least they have the right aspiration.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, LSE is actually the university to plagiarise.
Because the logo is so good. That's
why. I'll just say what Will was saying, that the role of networks is still very important in Croatia. Where I also come from. But I also think that it's the job market, because there are not actually that many jobs. So, you know, you have to satisfy a certain number of people who have connections. And I think that also plays an important role, that the economy is not expanding. According to what Will showed us, Croatia is not doing that badly as Kosovo or some other countries, but it's still not doing that well also.
I think if I can follow up on this point, in a kind of theoretical labor economics context, you would think of informality, informal networks for finding jobs as not as a corruption problem, but as a solution to information asymmetries in a very abstract world. But it may be true, also reflecting on what you said, that In a labour market where there's very little turnover and, you know, job creation, there's very little information to go about for formal networks. So if my average employee has zero previous jobs or one previous job, I have very little to rely on. So maybe relying on informal networks also, you know, as resolving my hiring, recruitment problem, is more efficient in that context.
It's extended internal labour markets are highly efficient.
You're neoliberal.
Well, it's efficient for the employer who's making the profit, but it's not necessarily socially efficient for the society as a whole. I mean, what would be better would be a more transparent labour market and an allocation of labour between activities which is based upon the market, not based upon personal connections. So, although it might be efficient given in the given circumstances, it's the circumstances that we're criticising, not the,
the
reaction to it.
Yeah. Okay, so this probably takes us to the very last point of your last slide, which was about, but the way you presented it was more like, you know, also additionally as a last factor, whereas it would seem to me that there's a lot, this may be much more central, the role of kind of labour demand and, you know, how vibrant the economy is and what kind of jobs it creates. You said, like, you know, if you, there's no use of having more STEM subject graduates if there's no demand, you know, jobs of that sort. And I mean, that also links, you know, to whether you have, you know, big turnover and fast job creation, then you will run out of private informal networks and you will actually use the public employment services and the more formal screening mechanisms. But I think also in all this, you know, even the reported skill gaps and skill shortages and the unemployment problems, to what is the sense, you know, of you know, how much of a problem is really a demand problem? And then, of course, if there's no labor demand, then people will go, mismatch will be higher because people will go on any job, especially if they're using formal networks. So how much is a kind of friction problem and supply problem, and how much is a demand problem?
Yeah, well, that's the key question, really.
You've got this investment here. I mean, the problem is, what is being invested in by whom and for what? And one of the substantial. One of the major problems is that there is very little investment in these economies, partly because they're not the kind of places which are fitted in well to European production networks, and the only place which people invest money in a lot of these countries is in real estate.
Some countries.
Well,
Montenegro.
There is this amusing story in the Kosovo, where you've got the Kosovo pension system is exporting as much money out of the economy every year to invest in productive investment abroad as is coming into Kosovo through remittances.
Well, that is true, but it's an interesting story you bring up. That's sort of slightly different, but the Kosovo pension fund was designed to be held abroad.
Yes, but
and it was invested in the ABN AMRO Bank in Belgium, which was subsequently bought by the Royal Bank of Scotland. And during this financial crisis, the Royal Bank of Scotland went bankrupt, basically, and was bought out by the British government. So by this nefarious route, the British government is now the proud owner of the Kosovo pension fund.
That might be, but in fact, the Kosovo pension fund has performed rather well. The point is that the reason why it was designed in that way, whether they put it in the hands of the wrong people, was a recognition that there was nowhere in the country that was worthwhile investing.
That was what the USAID opinion of the Kosovo economy was. They said there are no productive investments in the Kosovo economy, so we'll put it in Belgium, where there's lots of productive investments, and it's terribly safe. It's insecurity and uncertainty and risk in Kosovo, but it's guaranteed safety and security and zero risk in Belgium, which proved to be completely untrue. And in the financial crisis, the unit price of the Kosovo pension fund, I've got a picture of this, if you want to look at it, it went down. It's just one of these graphs, which is like, you know, a sort of cartoon graph of an economy in decline. And it went from sort of 1,000 to sort of 50. It's gone back up again. Okay. I think the point about investment is critical. I think you're asking a question about investment in training and human capital, really, rather than,
I'm talking about industries which engage in knowledge-intensive production processes. The only thing that people find worthwhile investing in there is improving their houses, or possibly, what she thinks about sort of building hotels on the seashore. There isn't actually very much scope for people who actually have this. And there is a very interesting graph, which I didn't comment upon, which actually comes back to, you've got your graph with the colours on it about the mismatches between what is demanded and what is being produced, the one that's got the blue and the red lines on it. Is that one there. The other one. There's the one that's got red lines going off into the negative dimension as well. That one there. Now, that actually shows some rather interesting things, because there's a hell of a demand for arts and humanities, social sciences, journalism and information, if I'm correct. But those are precisely the things which, a few slides back, you said they're producing loads and loads of people who have these skills, and these are things that nobody wants. But in fact, according to that, now go back to your...
I wouldn't say nobody wanted them.
Yes.
Well, I mean...
these people are working in the public sector, lot of them.
The STEM skills, where are the STEM skills sort of actually fitting into that picture there?
Well, it's the one on the top, the line on the top, the two lines at the top.
Engineering, construction, so there aren't enough of those.
Well, the blue line is the forecast.
Yeah, but there aren't enough people doing education, there aren't enough people doing arts and humanities, social sciences, journalism, information. And those were the things on slide almost one, where the implication was, from what you said, that there were too many of these people being produced and not enough of some other category.
Yeah.
first?
Well, in an ideal world, yes. If there were, this comes back to Vasily's point about are there jobs available for these people? You know, we have, at the moment, only 11% of students are going into the STEM subjects. And that might be rational because there's not the jobs for them. But you want to get them up to the 23% in the we find in the EU to create this knowledge economy. But then you have to create the jobs for them. So there has to be, you have to operate on both sides of the equation. And that's the tricky thing, because as you said, there's not much investment in those high value added industries. In some countries there's investment in real estate. In other countries it's in, well, foreign investment is one route to that, and most foreign investment has gone into the banking sector and telecom sector. So that creates some certain demand for high-level skills. But the question is, how do you turn these economies around in order to produce, you know, this sort of high-value-added industries?
It might be rational for me to sort of spin out my studies, have a part-time job in a bar, and maybe by getting to be known by the people in the bar, actually gets to work in one of these hotels which Taylor is telling me about, that's being built on the coast there, where there actually might be. That's one of the places where people are putting money in.
Well, there's only one small coastline in these countries, which is Montenegro.
Coast, it's full of hotels, so there's no more.
Very small. But I mean, I think one interesting insight which I could share with you on this tonight is we've been recently doing another project looking at foreign investment coming into the region from an unusual source, which is from the Gulf Arab states. And we've been doing this with the Middle East Centre at the LSE. And what we've found there is that the United Arab Emirates is investing a lot in the region, in different sectors, agriculture, real estate, transport, but also in defence. And so we took a look at the defence sector in Serbia. And this is an industry which has quite a long tradition, roots in the Yugoslav defence industry. And if you remember, the Yugoslav army used to be one of the biggest in Europe, fourth biggest, if not, I don't know, fourth, something like that. And they had a very high, the advanced defence sector. And this sector has now, was run down during the period of collapse of the Yugoslavia and the subsequent recessions and so on, but has subsequently been built up in Serbia. And it has recently won a contract with the United Arab Emirates to produce a highly advanced cruise missile, which will be it's highly advanced cruise missile. Hopefully it won't be used to bomb somebody's defence ministry, but The interesting thing about this industry is very much sort of under the surface. You don't hear a lot about it. You don't hear about this very successful export contract. And it's run by the Ministry of Defence, and it's essentially a state-owned sector within the Serbian economy, which has exports growing at a rate of 20% per annum, which is employing, you know, obviously lots of highly skilled engineers and so on, but it doesn't fit in with the IMF view of what the Serbian vision of what the Serbian economy should look like in the future, which is all about privatizing all the public remaining public enterprises, instituting labor reforms to push down wages even lower than they are today, introducing pension reforms, And other sort of the classic neoliberal agenda. And clearly, you know, the Serbian government is going along with this. It's pronounced proudly sort of saying, well, we're carrying out all these reforms. We're the most advanced reformer in the region. And the EU is sort of ticking all the boxes. And they're getting on, therefore, in the EU accession process. But at the same time, They have this very successful state-owned industry, which they're not talking about, and which is is developing in the direction of this sort of high-tech, high-skill, high-value-added sort of thing that you'd want. So, you know, which way do you want to go? Do you want to go in the sort of more state-driven industrial policy, or do you want to try to leave it all up to the market?
It's either arms or neoliberalism.
Yeah.
We're doomed. Yeah. Speed
again. Just as a footnote to what you're saying now, well, you talked a bit about the IMF, you talked about external actors like the Gulf States or perhaps the USA, but what is missing in terms of the final few slides on your presentation, where's the EU in all of this, in terms of not only a neoliberal economic model of reform, but also reforms in terms of labour market, in terms of education, in terms of conditionalities maybe which may be imposed as part of an accession process, or the other contractual arrangements the EU has with the region.
Yes.
What is the EU making a difference in what should be done?
It's making a difference to us, but it's funding the project.
Well, that's another reason why you should answer the question.
Well, I mean, there's the Bologna reforms, which they're pushing, and the Tempus program, which has had big influence on the education system in reforms and trying to improve quality. I mean, a lot of projects which have been put in place to try to, in different departments, different subjects, modernising the curricula, building up departments, building links. There's the Erasmus Plus program, which is providing scholarships. Yeah. So the EU is very aware, it's very high priority for them. I think in the EPA program as well, perhaps that's more around public administration reform and so on rather than education, but I guess that sort of is in the same sort of area of institutional administration reform. But
But yeah, the question is exactly that. Perhaps Bologna and Tempus are to do with the reform of the education system and conforming to certain European standards.
Yes.
But is there a concerted effort to make the education system produce graduates whose skills match what's needed in the labour market, etc.? And that's, you know, what does the EU do in that direction rather than simply saying, well,
yeah,
it has got...
Well, I think, the sort of simple answer is they're funding this research project so that they will know, and the decision makers in the region will know what are going to be the likely future areas for expansion,
so
and what is the match between the fields of study currently, and should they promote or restrict the private institutions and so on. So all these sort of questions are the sort of questions that the EU is asking at the moment, and it's hopefully this is part of the answer, but... That's why I also very much welcome your comments to put us onto the right track.
If I may add on that, the process of pre-accession and kind of leading to the negotiations, to chapter negotiations, has become now very detailed and in a way intrusive. So there's a lot of interaction between, the European Commission and the education sector, the ministers of education, as we experienced in this project, a lot of interaction and very sort of personal interaction. So for collecting information, getting the act together, trying to... So there's a lot of input coming from the European Union, which is directed directly into sort of ministries and policy making. At the policy-making level, which is about increasing the efficiency of policy-making, efficiency of monitoring, and the project is linked to that, and then kind of policy design, policy implementation in relation to whatever is the evidence base. So there's, an element of that is kind of capacity building. But it would be unlikely that... there would be coordinated effort across the Western Balkan countries on looking at, this type of skill mismatches and future demand for skills education if it wasn't for the EU. So, although despite the problems in communicating with the Commission, I think that's, definitely something very positive and potentially something that can produce tangible results. So.
There's a great difference, it seems to me. I mean, it's difficult to use the term the European Commission as a sort of homogenous thing here, because, I mean, there might be things which things like DG ECFIN are saying about policy in areas which they might or might not have a competence, which would be very different from whatever the Directorate for Labour might be saying, or the Directorate which is responsible for education and skills might be saying, or directorates which are responsible for science and policy. So that, yeah, who's actually saying what about what, and are they, who are you answerable to, who is but one bit of the whole thing? It seems to me it's some of those questions. Hence your very last slide and the last line of your last slide, which is, I don't mean this pejoratively, but is sort of a cop-out, because, yes, well, of course, if we could do that, but that comes back to demand side, it comes back to sort of investment policy, it comes back to, you know, sort of the overall nature of economic management in the country, which is something very, very different from everything up to the penultimate line of the last slide. But if the problem is really there, then, you know, kind of all the rest of this will just sort of simply follow. Of course, if there is a demand there, somebody will be producing the skills, people will be taking the qualifications, people will be not leaving the country but coming into the country, and whatever.
Will, the last words for you, and it's time to close. If you want to comment on that,
No. I mean, I think this is sort of is the key question. I think that given that, I mean, that's a sort of broad overview question. Direction of future economic management and future strategy for the economy as a whole. But you know, the specific issue about what to do about the university system, the difficulties that graduates have in accessing jobs and getting into the labour market today, and what problems employers have in meeting skill shortages because the wrong sorts of skills are being taught at the universities. I mean, they're much more immediate, practical problems that
I
think we can contribute to.
We're not investing in this area because there are insufficient tertiary skills being produced. If you actually looked at why does nobody invest in the West Balkans, or why do they only invest in one or two very selected things, I very much doubt if the reason they get it is because the tertiary education system is not producing the right kind of skills. They'll probably talk about all kinds of other things, like fragmented production systems, you know, kind of balkanization of this, and so forth and so on. They talk about everything, but yeah, they talk about that when you ask them very specifically. But why is nobody investing in the West Balkans?
Okay, we'll take that as the last question.
It's not that.
Stop. Okay, well, that's a good question.
Okay.
We'll talk about that later.
I can bring in my experience as private.
Okay. But very briefly, because we're
yes.
running out of time.
Yes, I'm operating in Belgrade as a foreign consultant for foreign investments. So I do this every day, let's say. And we don't have to forget that in these countries have decided for, so many years to attract labor-intensive investments. So the consequence were this trap, low-cost, low-salaries. I mean, we are speaking about salaries, many foreign investments of around 200 euros net, I mean. And there was a mismatch with the graduate people. Because I mean, the policy making, I mean, ministers were proposing to come in the countries, especially in Serbia, which is the country where I work and I know better, only to invest for cheap level cost. This was, I mean, the selling proposition. And there was a mismatch. In the last
let's say, 5 years, 3 years, the situation is changing. In the STEM sector, it's very hard to find someone, software developers. It's impossible to find. The average salary in Serbia is 370 euros net for a software dev is 1,500. In one company I'm running, we have software developers, and this is, you can't go below with 5-6 years of experience, for example. And so the point is, in the last years, also through, investment in the armies, there is a strategy to refocus, and to refocus the subventions, the governmental subventions, to let's say value-added technology drive in production, for example. Mubadala would like to invest in a chip factory in Serbia, for example, speaking about Emirates, but it's something that the ruling class and political class has elaborated on in the last 3 years. And now the incentives, until 5 years ago, the incentives to foreign investment in Serbia were based on numbers, only on the numbers of jobs, with no regards about, for example, the service paid. You could get more money than the service paid for 5 years, for example, up to 10,000 euros, paying a service of 300 euros net per month, without paying with complete leave of contribution. Now,
I'm afraid I will have to stop you.
No. Only the last thing only to say that this is a change of strategy. Now they are the incentives are focused on the technology and on the dimensions of the investments. So now they are trying to attract this kind of technology-driven investments.
Yeah.
This is something in effect.
Okay. Sorry. So some positive note at the end, yes. Okay. Well, Will, thanks very much for the presentation and the discussion, and thanks to everybody for coming. Please join me in welcoming again Will for his presentation.